This is VOA News via remote.
I'm Laurel Bowman.
Kremlin critic Alexei Navalny lost his appeal on Saturday against what he said was a politically motivated decision to jail him for nearly 3 years. But he said his faith in God and belief in the rightness of his cause was sustaining him. Navalny is Russian President Vladimir Putin's most prominent critic. He was jailed earlier this month for parole violations that he said were trumped up. Western countries have condemned the case and are discussing possible sanctions on Russia. Hundreds of protesters gathered outside Thailand's parliament after Prime Minister Prayuth Chan-o-cha and 9 ministers survived a parliamentary no-confidence motion on Saturday. One protester said, quote, "It was a disappointment, but expected." 2 people were killed in Myanmar's second city, Mandalay, on Saturday when police fired to disperse protesters. People protesting the February 1st military coup, and this is what emergency workers are reporting. It's been the bloodiest day in more than 2 weeks of demonstrations. Protesters took to the streets in several cities and towns with members of ethnic minorities, poets, and transport workers, among those demanding an end to military rule and the release of elected leader Aung San Suu Kyi and others. The number of confirmed coronavirus cases in Germany increased by more than 9,100 to over 2.3 million. Data from the Robert Koch Institute for Infectious Diseases showed on Saturday. And Japan's celebrations for Naomi Osaka's 4th Grand Slam tennis title went to orbit, with an astronaut tweeting congratulations from the International Space Station. This is VOA News. Thousands of protesters rallied in the capital of Armenia on Saturday to demand the resignation of Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan, who they accuse of mishandling last year's war with Azerbaijan. The prime minister has resisted pressure to step down since November, when he signed a peace deal brokered by Russia that ended the 6-week conflict with neighbor Azerbaijan. In the deal, which was received with hostility in Armenia, Pashinyan gave up swaths of territory in and around the disputed Nagorno-Karabakh region. This to end the fighting, which had claimed some 6,000 lives. Back in the 1990s, Armenian-backed separatists in Nagorno-Karabakh declared independence from Azerbaijan in a war for the province that left tens of thousands dead. But in the latest conflict, which erupted in late September, Turkey backed Azerbaijan, although it denied accusations from several sources that it had sent mercenaries to the front lines. And in other news headlines, the World Bank is working to standardize COVID-19 vaccine contracts that countries are signing with drug makers, and is pushing manufacturers to be more open about where the doses are headed. This as it races to get more vaccines to poor countries. This is according to Bank President David Malpass. He told Reuters he expected the bank's board to have approved $1.6 billion in vaccine funding for 12 countries, including the Philippines, Bangladesh, Tunisia, and Ethiopia, by the end of March, with 30 more to follow shortly thereafter. A Japanese Air Force officer and a U.S. Air Force instructor pilot were killed in a crash in Alabama, Japan's Air Self-Defense Force said Saturday. The Japanese second lieutenant and the U.S. instructor crashed as their T-38 was about to land at a local airport, according to a statement by the Japanese force. The United States has expressed concerns about Malaysia's plans to deport asylum seekers and others from Myanmar as Myanmar Navy ships arrived in Malaysian waters to pick them up. Last week, Reuters reported that Malaysia had agreed to return 1,200 Myanmar citizens after Myanmar's military, which seized power in that February 1st coup, offered to send ships to get them. And NASA's Perseverance became the 5th rover to reach Mars after landing impeccably on the red planet earlier this week. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clotty in Washington, D.C.
We set a target, deliberate target, that we expected to see at least 30% of women in the top management structures, the National Management Committee. We achieved 29% of this, and we're very proud of that.
Zambia's main opposition party, UPND, elects Hakainde Hichilema as presidential candidate for the August general election.
These coming elections are fair, credible, and inclusive. So we are calling everybody to a sense of patriotism and a big sense of responsibility to make these elections a feast, as we used to do in Benin.
The National Elections Commission of Benin steps up preparations for the upcoming April 11 presidential election.
The People's Democratic Party is organizing a national conference in a few weeks' time to deliberate on the security status of our country and the position of advice that our party will give to the government.
And the Nigerian main opposition party, PDP, demands the immediate resignation of Defense Minister Bashir Salihu Magashi. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Zambia, the main opposition United Party for National Development, or UPND, has elected Hakainde Hichilema as presidential candidate for the upcoming August 12 general election. The party and Mr. Hichilema are being congratulated by other opposition parties, including the Movement for Democratic Change, or MDC, for a successful intra-party poll which elected new representatives to lead the group. But the party's presidential candidate is coming under criticism for not having any opponent in the UPND poll that selected him. Critics also say his chances of defeating incumbent President Edgar Lungu in the upcoming elections are slim without forming an alliance with other opposition groups. For reaction to his election and preparations of the party ahead of the August elections, I reach UPND presidential candidate Hakainde Hichilema in the Zambian capital, Lusaka.
We hampered by the election by our colleagues into the leadership of our party once again, if I may say, retained. It's a humbling experience. At the same time, the flip side of that humbling experience is to acknowledge, is a recognition that this is a serious obligation to lead the party into elections, win the elections, and turn around the country's fortunes as the country's economy is damaged, social fabric is damaged. We are committed to changing the situation for the better to improve the lives of the people of Zambia.
Talking about the upcoming elections, how confident are you that this time around you will defeat incumbent President Edgar Chagwa Lungu? Because analysts are saying that it will be next to impossible for you to defeat him this time around. What is your reaction to that?
Peter, we are confident that will win the next election, August 12, 2021, primarily on the basis that the country's economy is basically damaged. People are suffering. Poverty is prevalent everywhere. School-going children are not in school. Those that have completed school are unemployed. And indeed, the cost of living is beyond affordability by many of our people. It cannot be reached at all. And it is time for change. This acknowledgement of time for change is widespread, and we have a duty to change our country. And the citizens have now understood our message. They've accepted our message. They know that we are the alternative. Millions of Zambians who suffer at the hands of the maladministration of the current government deserve truly a God-fearing and a servant leadership. Leadership that is visionary, and we offer that. Leadership that is competent, we offer that. And they know it. They've come to accept that as Zambians. And leadership that is devoid of ill intent. The people of Zambia know that we mean well. We'll change their lives for the better.
Well, Mr. Hichilema,
Some of these analysts are of the opinion that you have a better chance of defeating the incumbent if the other opposition parties join you to form an alliance with you leading the pack to defeat the president. So far, some people are saying that the recent collaboration you had appeared to have fizzled out, but they argue that that is your only way of defeating the incumbent president. What are your thoughts?
It is true that unit of purpose to deliver change for better, to serve people better, is important. And our unit of purpose in terms of a united Zambia or Zambia United has not fizzled away. We intend to even have a broader coalition this time, of course, under the flagship of the UPND, anchored on common intent, servant leadership, anchored on a clear vision, which is there, anchored on the need, the absolute need for unit of purpose, as independence was delivered around that theme, as multipartism in 1991 was delivered around that theme. We are confident that time is ripe for that to happen this year. And it's clear across the country that it's only unit of purpose that will serve this country. But unity is, you know, coalition is not only built around political parties, Peter. It's also built around consortium groups of citizens, individuals, civil society, all of whom agree that the current dispensation is failing the people of Zambia.
Let me take you back to the UPND elections. People are pointing to the fact that women performed creditably well, you know, to be part of the echelons of the party. What are your thoughts about the performance of women in the UPND in the just-ended general election for your party?
We are extremely proud of our women's performance in our intra-party UPND elections through our General Assembly. We set a target, deliberate target, that we expected to see at least 30% of women in the management structure, top management structure, the National Management Committee. We achieved 29% of this, and we're very proud of that. We're proud of our women. We're proud of our voters as well, who recognize the value, the importance of women in leadership in all the spheres of life. After all, they're our mothers, they're our sisters, they're our daughters, they're our nieces, so to say.
Hank Kainde Hichilema is the presidential candidate for the Zambian main opposition party, United Party for National Development, or UPND. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. In Benin, the Independent National Electoral Commission, or SENA, has stepped up preparations for the upcoming April 11 presidential vote. Valentin Ajibocha, press secretary to the chairman of the electoral body, says the organization is recruiting electoral agents for the poll. The agent, Ajibocha says, will be trained as part of the effort to ensure the election is transparent and credible. His remarks come after Emmanuel Tiandu, chairperson for the electoral body, says there's a new legal requirement for this year's vote. It demands a joint presidential ticket, a presidential candidate, and a vice presidential candidate. Additionally, the candidate would have to be sponsored by at least 16 mayors or members of parliament to qualify to compete in the presidential election. There would also be a runoff on May 9 if the candidates fail to garner the more than 50% threshold needed to be declared the winner. The opposition parties, however, reject the new rule, saying it appears to be designed to weed out any credible challenger to incumbent President Patrice Talon. They also accuse the electoral body of doing the bidding of the government, an accusation officials deny. To learn more about preparations to organize the April presidential election, I reached Valentin Ajibocha in the Beninese capital, Cotonou.
We are very advanced at in the preparations of this election because now we are at the process of recruitment of the electoral agents. The list, the informatic list, has been given. And now we are expecting the results of the health check from the Constitutional Court. So the Constitutional Court has submitted the candidates to different exams, health exams, and see whether they are really qualified to handle a country. So the medical team has already check them and have 72 hours to give back the result to the Constitutional Court, which will submit it to SENA for the treatment.
So which of the candidates have so far qualified for the presidential election?
Three teams has been retained to continue this process. We have the team made up with Sumanu Jemba, and his vice president will be maybe Paul Hunkwe. We have the team of Corante Kohwe and Irene Agosa. And the last one is that of Patrice Talon, the current president, and the vice president will be Zime Talata. But these three candidates has been submitted to a control, a health control at the Constitutional Court. It is just after that that we are going to know really those who have been retained to continue the process.
The opposition says the Electoral Commission is not truly independent and that the elections will not be transparent or credible. They are saying that the Electoral Commission is literally doing the bidding of the ruling party and by extension the president. What is your response to that?
The president of the National Electoral Commission used to say that the National Electoral Commission, SENA, is not qualified to vote the laws or to interpret the laws. The National Commission, Electoral Commission, is there to apply the laws. So once the law has been voted and promulgated by the president of the republic, the National Commission's role is to apply it. So whenever opposition or who else want to say something, they have to address themselves to those in charge of voting laws instead of coming to the National Electoral Commission, because whatever we say is applying these new laws that let them bring their files at the National Electoral Commission. So they are already following these new laws, but up to them to talk to the concerned ones, those in charge of voting laws, instead of coming to the National Electoral Commission. For we at the National Electoral Commission, this election will be fair and credible following the new laws of the country.
Has the Electoral Commission addressed all the concerns of the opposition groups or parties before the upcoming elections?
Many meetings has been done with different parties. And what you have to know is that we have some parties who has been recognized by the Minister of Interior during the course of the process, which means that at the beginning, there are some parties which were not there when we were talking to the different parties who are willing to partake to these elections. But once they have been recognized and the file is okay at the Minister of Security, they has been addressed. Many invitations, some of them answered, came to the invitation, but some other ones don't feel it necessary to be part of this, to partake to these meetings organized by the National Electoral Commission. But at the National Electoral Commission, we have an agenda and we are following our timetable. We are following our planning. So whatever we do has been already discussed with the politician before the process was engaged.
So what should be the expectations of Beninese in the upcoming elections from the Electoral Commission?
Beninese has to trust the institution, most of all, the National Electoral Commission, meaning that what we are doing at the National Electoral Commission is to make it sure that these coming elections are fair, credible, and inclusive. So we are calling everybody to a sense of patriotism and a big sense of responsibility to make these elections a feast, as we used to do in Benin.
Valentin Ajibocha is the press secretary to the chairman of the National Electoral Commission in Benin. He spoke with me from the capital, Cotonou. In Nigeria, the main opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP, is demanding the immediate resignation or firing of Defense Minister Bashir Salihu Magashi. It comes after the Defense Minister urged Nigerians not to be cowards, but instead to defend their communities by standing up to the armed bandits. This after gunmen recently kidnapped students from a government school in Niger State. The PDP says the defense minister's remarks are irresponsible and an affront to Nigerian citizens. The The party also says it is a clear indication that the minister appears to be incapable of resolving growing insecurity across the country. Kola Ologbodinyang is the spokesperson for the Nigerian opposition PDP. He tells me that the stance of the minister shows that the government appears ill-prepared to carry out what he says is the core duty of the administration to protect life and property as enshrined in the constitution.
The PDP asserts that General Bashir Magashi's statement declaring Nigerians as cowards, as reckless, irresponsible, and a clear demonstration of the abdication of his own responsibility as the Minister of Defense of the Federal Republic of Nigeria. His statement has shown clearly why President Muhammadu Buhari has failed woefully in office, because if the statement credited to General Magashi is the benchmark of deliberations at the cabinet meetings, it shows why Nigeria is in this sorry state.
But supporters are of the view that if Nigerians will stand up and defend their communities against these so-called miscreants, then it has a potential of sharply reducing the attacks on unarmed citizens. Do you think that assessment is fair?
That assessment can only lead to a situation in which warlords will emerge in every community. Our nation will now find herself under the commands and instruction of a cluster of warlords across the Federation. And that is a total negation of the responsibility of President Muhammadu Buhari in governance, because he swore to an oath to defend the territorial integrity of our nation. And the president himself once declared that those who are responsible for the insurgency and banditry are from the Sahel. It is therefore strange that Nigerians have become a pawn in the hands of foreign invaders, and the government is telling us that we should go and stand before terrorists unarmed. What would the implication of that be? It is totally irresponsible for the Minister of Defense to make even that suggestion.
Kola, some Nigerians are calling for his immediate resignation because they said his statements are regrettable. Others are saying he was just empowering Nigerians to also defend themselves, and that having help from the citizens will go a long way in reducing the insecurity in the country. What are your thoughts?
What a responsible minister of the Federal Republic of Nigeria would have suggested is that Nigerians should provide intelligence to the security agencies. It would interest you to know that even the minister, when he was asked if Nigerians should accept arms and ammunition on their own, he said no. That was his response. So if Nigerians have no access to arms and ammunition in accordance to the laws contained in the 1999 Constitution as amended, how can the minister ask them to go and face armed terrorists unarmed? So for us in the People's Democratic Party, we have already made a declaration that President Muhammadu Buhari should sack that minister and get him replaced. That is the demand of the People's Democratic Party. He should be removed from office. He should be sacked. And we haven't made that demand. Our position is that if the Buhari presidency maintains their silence on this issue, then it goes to show that General Magashi spoke their mind, meaning that the presidency have seen nothing wrong in what Magashi has said, because it represents the views, opinions, and dispositions of the Buhari presidency.
So what does the PDP suggest? happen right now in Nigeria as insecurity increases and as many Nigerians express concern about growing insecurity across the country?
Foremost, the PDP holds that President Muhammadu Buhari and his cabinet, as well as the service chiefs, should sit together and ascertain who the enemies are. As things stand in our country today, it looks like the government is not even sure of those that are fighting the nation. Yes, Mr. President, at some point, did say that those who are fighting the nation are from the Sahel. If truly they are from the Sahel, it means they are not citizens of this country, and they should be treated as enemies and as terrorists that are invading our nation. That is the position of the People's Democratic Party. However, the People's Democratic Party is organizing a national conference in a few weeks' time to deliberate on the security status of our country and the position of advice that our party will give to the government.
Kola Ologbodiyan is the spokesperson for the Nigerian Opposition People's Democratic Party, or PDP. He spoke with me from the capital, Abuja. Gunfire erupted in the Somali capital Mogadishu Friday morning after security forces cut off a planned opposition protest. The opposition is in a standoff with President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo over the election process and has been calling for him to leave office since February 8, when they say his term officially expired. For VOA, Mohamed Kahir reports from the Somali capital, Mogadishu.
Somali opposition leaders have accused the government of President Mohamed Abdullahi Farmajo of using disproportionate force to halt a peaceful protest that was planned for Friday. Heavily armed Somali military police, popularly known as Harmaat or Cheetahs, cordoned off all roads leading to the demonstration sites on Friday morning. They then exchanged gunfire with guards of opposition candidates in a hotel near the location of the planned rally. Former Prime Minister Hassan Ali Khayre, who is a main candidate in upcoming presidential elections, witness the gunfight.
Maanta waxa ku xigtay in murashaxiinta iyagoo banaan baxaya oo adduunyada.
He said security agencies fired live bullets at opposition leaders and protesters. He said that the heavy arsenal use resulted in unspecified loss of life and damages to property, including some from a motor that hit the main airport in the capital Mogadishu. Somali Prime Minister Mohamed Hussein Roble described the incident as unfortunate, but reiterated his administration will not tolerate armed protesters in the streets. He said the government is ready to address the disputes holding up the polls. Roble says his government is ready to listen to grievances from all sides regarding the delayed elections. He added that while peaceful demonstrations are guaranteed by the Constitution, the role of the security agencies in maintaining law and order must also be respected. The parliamentary and presidential elections were supposed to begin late last year, but have been delayed by disputes over the electoral committee tasked with overseeing the polls. While the two sides remain at loggerheads, unless one of possible escalation, unless the sides sit down and negotiate an end to the standoff. Professor Mohamed Haji Ingris of King's College of London recommended the government and opposition de-escalate the tension as quickly as possible.
There is a high risk that the ongoing armed confrontation in Mogadishu can pit the government forces against the fighters of the opposition groups along clan lines. The armed conflict will most likely strengthen the capability and capacity of Al-Shabaab to increase its attacks on Mogadishu. My suggestion is that for the government to cease the attempt to crack down dissent through forceful steps. And my suggestion for the opposition groups is that to end their call for protests in Mogadishu.
The international community, including the United States, has also called for calm and restraint by all parties involved. Mohamed Kahiye for VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
And you are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, the Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, the Rockefeller Foundation will continue to help African countries combat the spread of the coronavirus, according to William Asiku, the managing director for the group's regional office for Africa. His remarks come after the foundation announced a new grant of $12 million to the Africa Public Health Foundation. The grant, Asiku says, will help expand testing and strengthen contact tracing for the coronavirus through the Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. He also says the grant will support the ongoing effort to accelerate equitable access to testing technologies, and it will increase testing of asymptomatic persons and reduce community transmission of the disease in sub-Saharan Africa. For more insight on the initiative and efforts to help fight the coronavirus in Africa, I reach William Asiku of the Rockefeller Foundation.
This grant that we have given to the Africa Centers for Disease Control is going to focus on supporting 10 of the most vulnerable countries in Africa on their testing and tracing work. We recognize as the Rockefeller Foundation that the policymakers have a very difficult time making decisions about where to place their resources if they do not know where the disease is spreading, how fast it is spreading, and who has it. And so testing is still a very important aspect of this fight against COVID-19 pandemic. And the more we test, the more we are able to place resources, the more we are able to know where to lift lockdowns, where to put them, and so on and so forth. So this grant will support that work. And the reason we have chosen the Africa CDC to give this grant to is because we want to fight this pandemic from a Pan-African perspective. We want to end this pandemic for all, not just the well-off countries, but for all countries.
So, William, apart from the grant, is there any technical expertise of assistance that the Rockefeller Foundation can help the CDC in their effort to help Africans fight this disease on the continent? Secondly, is there a criteria by which any African country can qualify to be assisted with this $12 million fund?
Yes, so this grant will support the Africa CDC to hire technical expertise as necessary and deploy them at national level to the countries in which they will be assisting. So there is definitely a technical assistance component to this grant, really about the capacity and capability of the Africa CDC. We are also very keen, Peter, that post the pandemic, that the Africa CDC remains a strong institution for Africa and that it will be able to predict future pandemics and help African countries fight, future pandemics faster and more effectively than perhaps COVID-19 was fought. So this is an important technical assistance agreement for the Africa CDC, but it will also mostly support testing and tracing. With regards to individual countries, we are also talking to a number of member states directly around their vaccine response. So vaccines is also going to be an important area as we go forward. And we are looking at particularly national governments that have developed comprehensive deployment strategies, and we are working with them to see how we can assist in that regard.
William, is this grant a first step in the collaborative effort by Rockefeller Foundation to help strengthen the CDC moving forward after this pandemic is over?
Peter, yes. So this is definitely a first step in terms of supporting the Africa CDC. One of the things that the Rockefeller Foundation is particularly proud of is that we have a strong record of establishing institutions that endure and that are at the forefront of leading very important work in the field of agriculture, in the field of health, in the field of power around the world. And so one of the things we are very keen to do with the Africa CDC is to see that it is not only capacitated to help with fighting the COVID-19 pandemic, but that it is also an enduring institution and that it will be there post the pandemic. It will help to predict future pandemics. It will help countries with guidelines to fight future pandemics, but it will also help with a lot of public health work on the continent.
What is the Rockefeller Foundation's message to the people of Africa? One, the leaders. Two, in the fight against this COVID, in spite of the instances of misinformation and myth surrounding the disease?
I think my message to African leaders is, and to Africans in general, is really around being led by science in decision-making, not just about the COVID-19 pandemic, but also around the other public health challenges that Africa faces today and other diseases that Africa faces today, HIV, AIDS, malaria. Let us be led by the science. I think this pandemic has demonstrated that if we are led by the science, if we make national decisions around the science, that is the way to beat this pandemic. The second message I have to Africa and to the African leaders is that when the vaccine becomes available in Africa, that they should promote that everybody should feel safe in taking the vaccine. The vaccine is scientifically tested, and the vaccine is the only way that we know today of effectively fighting this pandemic.
William Asiko is the Managing Director for the Rockefeller Foundation Regional Office for Africa. He spoke with me from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. This week, scores of Zimbabwean refugees living in Botswana lost their bid to remain in the country and now face deportation if they do not voluntarily leave. The nearly 300 refugees fled Zimbabwe during the violent 2008 presidential election and fear persecution if they return. But officials from the UN Refugee Agency in Botswana and Zimbabwe say they are no longer at risk. For VOA, Nkodisi Dube reports from the Botswana capital, Gaborone.
The refugees have until February 28 to register for voluntary repatriation, but some, like Watson Chibi, say they do not want to return home. Chibi was among opposition MDC supporters who fled Zimbabwe for Botswana following violent clashes with members of Zimbabwe's ruling ZANU-PF party in 2008.
All refugees' hopes are down. We are waiting for anything to happen. UNHCR has rejected us. And the only option we have is going back home, going back to Zimbabwe. We are so skeptical. Are we really going to acquire even a passport, a travel document? Things are just really bad. But they are saying it's time up. You should go. You should go because you don't deserve international protection. Why? Because things are okay in Zimbabwe.
Chibi says the refugees want to take the matter to court, but do not have the funds.
We are trying to go to court. Will we have money to pay a lawyer to stand for us? No, we don't have money. Why? Because since 2010, there is what they call the encampment policy, where refugees are not allowed to work.
Zimbabwe's ambassador to Botswana, Henry Mkonweshuro, has assured refugees it is now safe to return.
What I am assuring you is that His Excellency welcomes you back to Zimbabwe. It is a part of the government's desire to help Zimbabweans in Zimbabwe.
The UNHCR Protection Officer at the Dukwi refugee camp, Olivia Mugambi, recently told refugees the situation in Zimbabwe has improved.
We did a lot of research in the country's situation, and we believe that the circumstances that led it to be in 2002 and 2008 have significantly changed, and the situation is now conducive for return.
The UN Refugee Agency says returning refugees will be assisted with a cash grant, food package, and hygiene items. Officials say the Botswana government will provide transport, while the reception of the returnees, their documentation, and reintegration will be the responsibility of the Zimbabwe authorities. Mkwandisi Dube for VOA News, Gaborone.
The United Nations Children's Agency, or UNICEF, says the lives of 3 million children in the Democratic Republic of Congo, or DRC, are at risk, with many of them living in displacement camps without access to basic social amenities. For VOA, Mavis Ochery has more from Juaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
A succession of brutal attacks by fighters using machetes and heavy weapons have forced whole communities in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo to flee with only the bearers of possessions. Entire families, including children, have been hiked to death. Health centers and schools have been ransacked and villages set ablaze. Alista Tinkert, the UNICEF communications officer based in Goma, says many of the children living in displacement camps or staying with host communities are suffering immensely. He says numerous armed groups operate in the region almost every week. There are reports of new attacks by the various militant groups operating in the region. He says UNICEF and other aid agencies fear that unless something is done quickly to help, the situation for children will worsen.
I think first and foremost, the activities of the armed groups in the area needs to be stopped, because although the Congolese army has also been accused of rights abuses, it is, I think, primarily the various armed groups that operate in the region that are responsible for a lot of the displacement and a lot of the children suffering.
Tinkert say children in the region have been denied proper livelihoods as they do not have access to educational and health services, and they lack clean water and sanitation services.
Some of these children have witnessed the most hideous acts of violence, machete attacks and other things. We came across one instance, I mean, it's not difficult to find, I have to say. We came across several instances of children who were orphaned because their parents had been killed in machete attacks. One child who had been left for dead in the jungle. Another child who'd been who'd had his leg amputated in a machete attack. I mean, it's absolutely horrific what's happening there, and that's why UNICEF is so worried.
He says an estimated 5 million people in Ituri, North Kivu, South Kivu and Tanganyika in the eastern DRC are displaced. He says these areas were food insecure after years of displacement, and given the current situation, there is no chance of the problem ending soon. The huge region means it can be hard for aid agencies to reach displaced people, especially when security is poor. And when agencies get to the villages, they find great damage.
One of the things that's so striking about eastern Congo, the east of the DRC, is that you can go through lots of ghost villages. We saw them all over the east of DRC, where villagers have fled. And even though the houses are still in perfect condition, in some cases you still see furniture in the house, that the people that live in them are too frightened to go back. Children in the camps missing out on so many things. We came across a mother in one camp in Ituri province who wasn't able to feed her children, and she herself had malaria. She wasn't able to get treatment for her own malaria.
He says UNICEF efforts to the region now are underfunded and call for more funding to care for displaced people. UNICEF has found some cases children voluntarily join rebel groups because life in the camps offer no better alternative. Those children then grow up in an environment where violence and sexual abuse are common. Tinkret say UNICEF and its national partners and other aid organizations are providing a rapid response program to offer temporary solutions, providing cooking utensils, jerry cans and other essentials to people. Reporting for VOA, this is Mavis Autry in Jaso in the Ashanti region of Ghana.
Right now, it's time for music from our African collection.
but they know about pass. Them buy Jimmy too, but you they buy them double. I know they London go, no me I won't come out.
Tulia yuko nyumba, ngari, 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 kwako nimepaki gari, gari, Novemba to January.
Believe me, her dreams have the only cure. Her love is
Music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, managing editor Bill Eagle, reporter Douglas Impuga, and producer Saida Hamdoun, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, the eyes do not carry the load, but they know what the head can carry. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, D.C. Good evening, Africa.